The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Morris Williams, and I'm a member of the Foundation's Board of Directors. First, a couple of housekeeping reminders. Please turn off your cell phones. Please remember no flash photography. And please buy Richard Clark's latest book for the book signing that will be upstairs after the lecture and the Q&A, which will follow Mr. Clark's comments. Mr. Clark has been to the Free Library before, but he also has a Philadelphia connection because he's a 1972 graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, he shifted his allegiance to Harvard, where he, for the last 3 years, has been teaching a course at the Kennedy School in National Security Management, which, as he commented, draws a number of students not only from the governmental world, but from the Harvard Business School. So there's a lot of cross signing up for his course there. He is currently the chairman of Good Harbor Consulting, which has evolved from three men sitting around his dining room table to a 40-person firm, that does strategic planning and corporate risk management, both here and around the world. Mr. Clark is most famous for his first book, which was a bestseller, Against All Enemies, but he's also written two works of fiction, and if you want some Middle East espionage thriller, I highly recommend in particular Scorpion's Gate, which I very much enjoyed. His new book, Your Government Failed You, is not just about 9/11, but more importantly, is about the failures that have continued in terms of government security and government actions. And without further ado, please join me in a wonderful Philadelphia welcome so Richard Clark can tell us more about these failures.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Morris, and thank you all for coming on such a beautiful spring day to be willing to sit inside for an hour. I appreciate your coming here. We were just commenting before I came out that I've two events scheduled as part of this book tour. Whenever you have a new book, you're supposed to run around the country promoting it. And I've only got two public events scheduled. This is one of them, and it is the first. And the reason I've chosen to come back here is the warmth that you have always shown me the other times I've been here with the other books. This has been one of the best audiences in the country in terms of the quality of the questions and your knowledge about the subjects and your warmth and welcome. So I told our book planners, I'm not going to do many of these events this time, but I want to go back to the Free Library. So thank you so much for having me. And I'm glad to hear, every time I come back, I'm glad to hear of the progress of the expansion plan for the library. The first time I came here, it was kind of still an idea, I think. And now I understand that you may even break ground this year. So congratulations on that. Libraries remain important, and books remain important. There was a time not so many years ago, and you remember it, when we were all told that we were going to have little handheld computer books. They haven't done so well. And that, in fact, knowledge was no longer going to be transmitted in these big 200, 300, 400-page books. Everything would be short little articles on someone's blog. Well, so much for the death of books. If any of you have been following the news yesterday and today, what's the lead story? It's about a book, Unfortunately, not mine. But I have been asked by a number of news organizations in the last day or two to compare what is happening to Scott McClellan, the former White House press secretary, who is releasing his new book next week, what is happening to him versus what happened to me several years ago when I came out with my first book and criticized the Bush administration. And I haven't really had a chance. You know, when you're on CNN with Wolf Blitzer or something like that, you've got about 2 minutes to answer the question, and then they're into the commercial or the weather. So I haven't really had a chance to fully talk about the differences and the similarities between what's happening with Scott McClellan and what happened to me. So I thought I would start, before I talk about my book with you, I thought I would talk about something that's in the news and topical, which is the controversy about the new White House press secretary's book. When I heard what White House spokesmen were saying yesterday and the day before about McClellan's book, I heard an echo. They said he was a disgruntled former employee and that he was, anyway, when he was in the White House, he was out of the loop. So I got on the Internet, went back and did a little historical research, and I found that when my book came out in 2004, the White House spokesman said that I was a disgruntled former employee. The White House spokesman was Scott McClellan. So apparently somewhere in the Bush White House, there's a file that says, in case of book by former employee, break glass, open file. And there are talking points. And the first talking point is he's a disgruntled. The second talking point is he's out of the loop. And the person who said that about me was a guy named Dick Cheney. The New York Times the next day commented, Clark wasn't out of the loop, he was the loop. I think that was a compliment. I'm not sure. But I think those days when Against All Enemies came out in 2004 are different than the days today. Now, they were both presidential election years. And one of the comments that McClellan is getting is, oh, you waited to say this. You waited to publish your book until the presidential election year. Well, maybe. What's wrong with that? People need to pay attention during a presidential election year, and they need to think about the presidency, and they need to learn from our past mistakes, like George Bush. But in 2004, when my book came out and I criticized the Bush strategy of dealing with terrorism and going after Iraq, the polling data then showed that roughly 80% of the American people thought invading Iraq, thought going to war was a good idea. Roughly 80% of the American people thought that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. And so when I criticized the White House and criticized the war, I got criticized very heavily. And I was called unpatriotic, which seemed a little ironic to me, but in any event, there was some very harsh criticism. Over time, people have now understood that, in fact, it was a lie that the White House generated when it said Iraq had something to do with 9/11. And the more recent polling data shows that about 28% of the American people now believe that lie. So for Scott McClellan to come out and say now, in 2008, that the Iraq war was justified by White House lies and a propaganda machine, well, you know, it's not quite the same as having said it 4 years ago. 4 years ago, we had the opportunity to elect Senator Kerry and to stop the war. 4 years ago in that presidential election, it wasn't too late to correct some of the mistakes. And 4 years ago, it was a hard sell to convince the American people that the president and his administration had lied. Frankly, a lot of the American people were offended at some upstart like me saying the president and his administration had lied and were engaged in a propaganda exercise to get us into war, a war that we didn't need to fight, a war that would be massively counterproductive. Now, I think saying all of that in a book in 2008 is what the Pentagon staff call a BFO. The Pentagon staff have these little acronyms for everything. And BFO means a blinding flash of the obvious. And I think the other difference between what McClellan is doing and what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to think about solutions. My new book, Your Government Failed You, goes through about 8 different national security problems. The military, intelligence, homeland security, global warming, cybersecurity. And in each case, I try to identify what's gone wrong. That's the easy part. Saying where your government has failed you and demonstrating that it has failed you is like shooting fish in a barrel, unfortunately. Coming up with ideas about how to fix it, that's a little harder. And so in every chapter of Your Government Failed You, after I talk about the failures, I try to propose some solutions. Now, many of them are a little geeky, a little technical, and sometimes that's what it takes when you're talking about fixing the U.S. intelligence community. There's no easy solution. There's no silver bullet. But the reason I started this book was when I said to the 9/11 Commission and to the families of the victims of 9/11, your government failed you, I thought that was a very unique event in American history, 9/11, a government failure of that order of magnitude. Because I'd grown up watching the U.S. government do some pretty incredible things that were successful, or relatively successful. After World War II, the United States brought all the veterans back and sent them to college under the GI Bill. That really changed our country. It gave them home mortgages under the veterans' mortgage bills, and that really changed our country. And the interstate highway system in the 1950s, all of those changes were for the good, were positive. We recognized in the 1960s we had a civil rights problem for the preceding 100 years. And with a little struggle, sound effects for the struggle, with a little struggle, we fixed that. Now, it's still not perfect, but we saw a problem in our country, and we addressed it. And at the same time, we were dealing with the civil rights movement and the issues there. President Kennedy had launched the space program. And we did an incredible thing that we haven't done in the last 30 years. We put men in space and went to the moon. Later on, Al Gore or somebody invented the Internet. You know, Al Gore takes a hard rap for that, but he did play a key role in getting the funding necessary. And at the time he did, no one understood what he was talking about. Now they do. Al Gore has that problem. He's always so far ahead of everybody else that people don't believe him. But he usually turns out to be right. So I grew up with this notion that government did tackle really big, hard problems. And while it wasn't perfect, it did okay. And sometimes it did really well. And government was, therefore, a place where you wanted to go to work, spend your life and spend your career. As a teenager, listening to John Kennedy talk about government service, I was inspired, and I know a lot of people of my generation were inspired to go into government service as a very high calling. Now, as Morris mentioned, I'm teaching occasionally at the Kennedy School of Government. And it has on the wall at Harvard the quote, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." But the students that I teach there very frequently are asking me not what they can do for their country, but what they can do instead of going to work in the government, even though it's a school of government. They're not inspired to go into the government, A, because it's not going to pay them very much, and they can get paid more elsewhere, but B, because they look at the government and all they see is a series of failures. That's what I'm trying to find out in the book. Why is there this series of failures? 9/11, when I said your government failed you and thought it was a unique event, turns out not to be a unique event. There have been failure after failure after failure since then. And to be frank, there were significant failures before 9/11 as well. But if you look at Iraq, first of all, the decision process to invade Iraq was an enormous failure. But then an important difference. Then there's another failure where the U.S. military fails to understand how to fight that war. You know, for years, politicians had a mantra. They said the American military, Republicans and Democrats said this, the American military is the best trained, best equipped, best led military in the world. And I can show you video clips of every major American politician saying exactly those words. They all said the same thing. And then we went into Iraq, and the troops were not trained to fight an insurgency. They were not equipped to deal with roadside bombs and the kind of terrorist threat they had there. They didn't have body armor. They were trying to find metal scraps in Iraq to use as body armor. They were driving around in canvas-sided vehicles. And only now are they getting adequate numbers of modern protected vehicles. They weren't the best trained. They weren't the best equipped. And they weren't the best led. Because the military that led them, the generals that led them, agreed to go in to Iraq with too few troops. And what's the result of not having counterinsurgency training, not having the right equipment to protect our troops, and having too few troops? The result is that thousands of Americans get injured, and hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans died who should never have had that happen to them, who could have been protected. So even putting aside whether or not you think we ought to have gone into Iraq in the first place, which was a decision made by politicians, the military, the generals, made mistakes in carrying it out. Not the soldiers. I think we all have to love and respect our men and women over there for all they've gone through. But that doesn't mean we can't criticize the generals. We can draw a distinction. And we need to draw a distinction because the generals made a lot of mistakes. But that mistake piled on the mistake of going into Iraq. Now we get the third mistake piled on top of that, which is we're not taking care of our veterans. We ask them to go over there, risk their lives, and they get wounded, they get head injuries, they get post-traumatic stress disorder, and they come back here, and the Army Department tries to say that they're not sick. And the Veterans Administration doesn't have enough trained specialists in brain injury or in post-traumatic stress disorder to take care of them. There was a 50% increase in the last year, 2006 to 2007, a 50% increase in soldiers coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder. And we don't have the trained specialists, we don't have the hospitals to take care of them. Mistake after mistake after mistake. About 2 years ago, they brought the head of the Veterans Department before a congressional committee and said to him, "Why haven't you planned for more veterans coming back from the war injured?" And he said, most incredible thing I've ever heard. He said to the senator, well, no one told us there was going to be a war with a lot of casualties. So whether you look at homeland security or terrorism or intelligence or global warming, cybersecurity, all these national security-related issues, the government has failed and continues to fail. And they're important failures. They're not just little things. They're things that are going to affect us, and they're certainly going to affect our children and our grandchildren. So Your Government Failed You is a book that tries to figure out why this is going on. What's wrong? How do we fix it? And there are lots of suggestions in the book. But there's a theme in all of these areas of some common threads. And among the common threads are what I call PPOM, politicizing, lack of professionalism, outsourcing, and misdiagnosis. Politicizing. Anytime a national security problem or issue comes up, what's the first thing that Republicans and Democrats do? They try to find a way of dealing with that issue, talking about that issue, in a way that hurts the other party. Every time they try to make the issue a wedge issue to divide us as a people into people who are supporting the Republicans or supporting the Democrats. National security shouldn't be a wedge issue. National security should be something that we all agree on. It used to be. We all want our country to be secure. We are all patriots. And they say, well, you're unpatriotic for criticizing. No, no, no. We are patriotic for criticizing. And we all ought to try to find a way of dealing with these national security issues without making them political. I noticed yesterday the three presidential candidates, because there still are three, I guess, the three presidential candidates issued a joint statement on our policy towards Sudan and the awful genocide in Darfur. That's a great first step, because there's no reason for us to disagree as a nation about genocide anywhere. What we need to do is when candidates for the Senate or the Congress or the presidency start politicizing these security issues, we need to call foul and say, we don't want to hear that. We want you to come up with solutions. We don't want you to come up with political arguments. Politicization. Professionalization. You know, when you go to a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant or even these days an automobile mechanic, that person has been trained and certified. Doctors have been board certified. They had to go to recertification every year or two, continuing education programs. There are boards of accountability. There are boards of review. You can't publish an article in an academic journal without having peer review. And yet, national security is done without any sense in the government that there are qualifications to work on these important issues, without any sense that people should be certified, recertified, without any process for peer review or oversight or accountability. And we find political appointees with little or no background handling some of these important issues. When we opened the embassy in Baghdad after the invasion, we built this huge green zone monstrosity in Baghdad and sent out lots of people to staff this largest U.S. embassy in the world. Many of the people that we sent out had to get their passports for the first time because they'd never been out of the country before. Now, you might think maybe we only should send people who speak Arabic. Well, that wasn't possible. It wasn't even possible to get people who'd been outside the United States before because they filled that embassy with political appointees. When they created the Homeland Security Department, this huge behemoth bureaucracy that doesn't work too well, the entire upper management of that department filled with political appointees at a higher rate than in any other department in the government. So the new Homeland Security Department? Security? After 9/11? We don't put experts in there. We put in political appointees. You know, I worked with colleagues in England and Australia and Germany and Japan, my counterparts when I was in the government, and I got to know their governments. They're all professionals. They have one or two political appointees in every department. One or two. And everybody else is a professional, trained, retrained, accountable, subject to review. Well, instead of doing that, we're doing the O, outsourcing. Congress has restricted the number of people that can work in the government, and then Congress gives the government more jobs to do. So you can't do more jobs with the same or fewer people. What happens? Jobs that used to be done in the government, jobs like intelligence, secret analysis, are now being done by private for-profit companies. You drive around the Beltway in Washington, and there are all these beautiful new office buildings. You wonder, gee, who's in them? Companies that are making money, publicly traded companies, companies that are making money doing the work the government used to do. We are outsourcing intelligence analysis, homeland security work to for-profit companies. Now, I'm not talking about Halliburton in Iraq. We could, but I'm not talking about Halliburton in Iraq. I'm talking about people, if you go to the National Counterterrorism Center in Washington, the National Counterterrorism Center, half the people working there don't work for the government. They look like they do until they all wear badges around their necks. The green badges are people that work for the government. And the brown badges are people who work for for-profit companies doing the same job as the guy next to them. And half the people there at the National Counterterrorism Center are wearing brown badges because they work for for-profit companies. We are outsourcing national security out of the government. And that means the institution decays because those for-profit companies don't care about maintaining the quality of the government. All they care about is getting their contract renewed, which, by the way, is one of the reasons they're constantly telling you there's a threat. Because if the threat goes away, their contract goes away. Funny thing. Politicization, lack of professionalization, outsourcing, and misdiagnosis. We are, because we don't have peer review, we don't have accountability, we don't have an analytical process, we are repeatedly misdiagnosing the problem. And if you don't know what the problem is you're trying to solve, you can't solve it. I'll give you a couple of examples. There are lots of examples in the book. The one that's most obvious is what the Pentagon calls the GWAT, the Global War on Terror. The only problem with that, Global War on Terror, is it ain't global. Much of it is not a war, and it's not really about terror. What do I mean by that? What they're referring to in the Global War on Terror is actually a fight largely in the Islamic world, not in Asia, not in South America. It's largely in the Islamic world. And while there is a war going on in Afghanistan related to terrorism, most of the fight against the terrorists is with police and intelligence work. That's how we captured the ones we captured. And most of the way we have to combat the terrorists is through the battle of ideas, the power of ideology. The only way that we can defeat their ideology is helping our Islamic friends to craft a counterweight to the attractiveness of Al-Qaeda and the other terrorist groups. It's not global. It's not usually a war. And it's not on terrorism. Terrorism is a tactic that these groups use, among other tactics. Other tactics including an ideological appeal to people. It's not a global war on terrorism. It is a fight against a small minority, radical, violent group within Islam. Another example of misdiagnosis is global warming. Now you say, well, global warming, that's not a national security problem. Oh, yes, it is. Oh, yes, it is. Nothing threatens this country more at this point in our lives as a country than global warming. I talked a little while ago about Al Gore, and I have a lot of sympathy for him. When I was trying in the mid-1990s and the late 1990s to raise awareness about the threat of terrorism, and people were looking at me like I had two heads, I now look back at that and I think about Al Gore trying during that same time frame and even today to talk about global warming and climate change. And I remember the first President Bush, the incumbent's father, ridiculing, joking about Al Gore and calling him Mr. Ozone, Mr. Ozone Head, because all he ever did was talk about global warming. And nobody understood, and nobody thought that it was a problem. I think when people look back 100 years from now on the failures, the major failures of government in the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, it's not going to be terrorism. It's not going to be any of the things that we typically think about. The major failure of government has been to do something in time about global warming. And much of that failure is a failure of the American government, because the American government has, until very recently, been in denial that there even is global warming. And we're doing almost nothing about it. What we hear from the president, and we heard this from Richard Nixon, and every president since Richard Nixon. I went back and looked at the State of the Union addresses of all of the recent presidents, and every single president has said, we have to have energy independence. Richard Nixon declared that we would achieve that by 1980. Missed that target. Energy independence sounds like a great idea. When you pump gas at $4 a gallon or $4.50, energy independence sounds like something we should achieve. We're never going to achieve energy independence, and we shouldn't. It's misdiagnosing the problem. The problem is not where we get our oil and gas. The problem is how much energy do we create, and does it create a carbon increase? Every nation in the world imports gas and oil. I'll say that again. Every nation in the world imports gas and oil. I spend a lot of time out in the Arab world, and even these countries like Iran, like the United Arab Emirates, like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, they import because they don't have everything they need. They may have one kind of oil, or they don't have gas. They may have another kind of oil that needs to be refined somewhere else. What's the problem? It's not energy independence. It's carbon output. How do we stop carbon output? That's the issue. And if we ask that question, the first and most obvious thing to do is to stop cars, to stop the internal combustion engine. When Al Gore talked about stopping the internal combustion engine 10, 15 years ago, people really thought he was nuts. Now there's a growing awareness that we need to have electrical cars, electric-powered motors. Plug-in hybrids are probably the best solution. So, what's wrong with that? Let's all go out and make and buy plug-in hybrids. Well, that's a good idea, except for the fact that the entire electric power grid will collapse. The electric power grid is right at the edge now of being able to produce and transmit as much as we need. And if we have everybody going home every night and plugging their car in, we'll have blackouts. So you're not going to like the solution. But the solution is we need to produce more electricity, not less. A, to get those plug-in hybrids. B, to do things like get water. we're going to have big cities because of global warming. Big cities like Las Vegas and Phoenix and whatnot needing water. They're going to have to recycle water. They're going to have to desalinize the ocean and pump it. All of that takes enormous amounts of energy, enormous amounts of electricity. So we need more electricity. And the solution that everybody's come up with so far is solar power and wind power. Well, that's nice, except it doesn't work. Solar power and wind power can give you a certain percentage of what you need, but they're not always on. And we need to increase power that is always available and doesn't increase the carbon output. You're not going to like it, but the best way to increase electricity for plug-in hybrid cars, for desalinization, is nuclear power. Now, what politician is going to stand up and tell you, we need a lot more nuclear power plants? That's the politicization part. There are so many of the solutions that need to be done that no one will talk about because they're not politically popular. We all remember Three Mile Island and worrying about the breeze coming down from Harrisburg. Hasn't happened since. In fact, the number of nuclear accidents is a remarkably small percentage, far smaller than any other way of producing power. And since Three Mile Island, we all remember it, but it was a long time ago, Jimmy Carter was president. Jimmy Carter dressed up and went into the plant. You remember that? Since then, nuclear technology has gotten a heck of a lot better. So every time I say this, people say, well, you must be paid by the nuclear power industry. You must be paid by the nuclear lobbyists. No, I'm not. I'm just looking at a problem like global warming and dissecting it and saying, what do we do about it? And unfortunately, in the near term, some of the solutions are solutions that are hard to sell. Hard to sell in a climate where everything is politicized. So this book, Your Government Failed You, is about these kinds of issues, national security issues, about the government not working, and hopefully in a couple of cases at least, about ways that we can solve the problem. I thought I'd end by reading a small bit from the last couple of pages. We need to do two sets of things. Abroad, we must act boldly to reestablish our moral leadership, respect for international law, support for human rights. We must refocus our efforts on countering the violent Islamist extremists, chiefly through non-military means, helping our friends wherever possible with law enforcement and intelligence, as they develop an ideological counterweight to Al-Qaeda. A major new international effort is required to secure radiological material from falling into the wrong hands. If another government will not act against violent Islamist extremists, we should, consistent with our legal standards. At home, there are things we can and should do to reduce the important security vulnerabilities, but we need to do them in ways that are consistent with our Constitution and our beliefs about civil liberties. We can also do them without all of the massive counterterrorism bureaucracy and the government industrial complex that has grown up. After Iraq, our army will need to be rebuilt, and our veterans given the health care and opportunities they need to lead successful lives following their service. We must urgently turn our technological prowess to achieving specific accomplishments in energy technology, climate change mitigation, and in cyberspace security. Good government in national security also means active oversight by truly independent inspectors, by interagency policy committees, and by informed congressional committees. Use of smart regulation and restoration of analysis in government are both going to be required to restore effective national security programs. We must develop a set of specific and clear national security goals, even bold goals, empower managers to achieve them, hold those managers accountable when they don't achieve them. And most importantly of all, our president must once again make federal service a noble calling. Off the piazza in Siena, in Tuscany, there are two murals painted by Ambrogio Lorenzi. They have adorned the Palazzo Pubblico since 1328. One of these murals depicts a country in which farmers cultivate their fields, merchants sell their wares, scholars study, and the people are happy. In the other mural, there is obvious poverty. People are in chains. The oppression and depression are palpable. The two panels are called Good Government and Bad Government. They knew then, in 1328, as we have relearned in recent years, that there is a direct relationship between people's security, health, prosperity, and happiness on the one hand, and on the other hand, the concerted practice of good government. If we stop denigrating government, if we stop using government as an instrument of partisan punching bags, if we work in a bipartisan, nonpartisan way to rebuild the institutions of national security, your government will fail you less, and you may even be proud of it once again. Thanks very much. Thank you.
We have limited time for questions. So, and I see a lot of hands already, so I'm just telling you we're not going to get to all of you, unfortunately. Please phrase your question as a question. Stick to one. Gentleman in the blue right there.
Thank you for writing that book and bringing it to us. Two questions.
Sir, one question, please.
They're short.
I have a lot of questions.
Have you been consulting with any of the presidential candidates on any of these suggestions? Secondly, can you say that in the past few years, any of your suggestions have influenced people of power?
I began about 2 years ago to think about some of these ideas and getting them to candidates and politicians. And I decided to wait and see who called me and see if anybody wanted my advice rather than going around sort of forcing it on them. Only one candidate called. I didn't care, frankly, if they were Republican or Democrat. I would have briefed as many of them as asked for it. Senator Obama called me. And I have briefed him on terrorism, on homeland security. And every once in a while, I turn on C-SPAN. Yes, I watch C-SPAN. Hey. Is that really a surprise? I turn on C-SPAN, and I hear some of what I have been telling him coming out of his mouth. And not because he's parroting it back, but because he understands it. And I find that very comforting. Now, the implication here is you're trying to convince Obama of something so you can go work in the Obama administration. I want to make very clear when I say that I'm advising Obama at his request that one of the things I have told him is I already spent 30 years as a civil servant. I already spent 30 years in national security. And for whatever sin I committed that made me do 30 years at hard labor, that's enough.
Another question. Right here, second row.
Didn't the Pentagon try to get enough troops into Iraq and they were turned down?
Some people in the Pentagon. What happened was that the for every imaginable scenario, the Pentagon has a plan already done. And there was a plan going back to 1993 to invade Iraq if we ever had to. And it called for 400,000 troops. And so that's the plan that was taken off the shelf. And that's the plan that General Shinseki, as you mentioned, knew about. He was the head of the army at the time. Donald Rumsfeld said no, he wanted to do it with a quarter of that number. And the military commander in charge of that region of the world, General Tommy Franks, said okay. And he sat down with Rumsfeld and took the plan and started lining out units. And they got the plan down to little more than a quarter of the number that was required. My complaint in the book is that General Franks and other generals are complicit in that decision by Rumsfeld. They knew it was wrong. They knew it would get Americans killed. And it did get Americans killed.
Another question, right here in the third row, fourth row, sorry.
Thank you. What are the chances, do you feel, of our ever developing a civil servant-run think tank inside the government as we see in most other industrialized nations? I understand that such a group began under Nixon and was ruined under Carter. But is there any chance of its being revived?
I'm not familiar with the Nixon experience. I'm not surprised, though. I would think it is a good idea that could be revived because the government, you know, what happens when government fails as badly and as often as it has is that people do begin to think about solutions and do understand that there's a need for it. I think a civil service run program to do this accountability, to do the development of the training and recertification, to do the policy planning, and to have a sort of second guess, a source of expertise, is essential. And whether you build it as one institution, as you seem to suggest, or you do it in every department, that is what I'm talking about. For national security issues, getting professionals, and having standards and accountability. Now, professionals screw up too, but less. And if you combine the professionals with a process for analysis, for accountability, for second guessing, if we treat national security the way we treat dentistry or automobile mechanics, we would improve it enormously.
Lady in the red and yellow dress, if you would wait for the microphone, ma'am. Carol, can you get her a mic? Could you hold your hand up, ma'am? Thanks.
I have to congratulate Mr. Clark on perfectly pinpointing all the problems in this administration. One problem nobody seems to mention is overpopulation. I have read repeatedly that the Arab population doubles every 40 years. So how can we ever hope to get a handle on terrorism when that's the only outlet they have? They don't have jobs. They don't have a stable government. And that's the only thing they know.
Well, that's true in a couple of Arab countries. It is true in a couple of Arab countries that populations are growing really rapidly and the economy is not catching up. And I'm thinking of Morocco. I think of Jordan. I think of Egypt. But there's another end of the Arab world that is producing oil. And will be for a very long time, despite fears of the oil running out, where there's a great deal of money, more all the time. And so the Arab world, taken as a whole, has the resources to rebuild their economy, to modernize, and there's enormous modernization going on in places like Qatar, in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and elsewhere, where they are looking for people to do the jobs. So I think there's hope for the Arab world, for the Islamic world, modernizing and handling its population growth. The population growth is less of a problem, I think, than the fact that there's no ideology for the young people to be part of. So you have all these new, millions of new 18, 21-year-olds coming along in some of these Islamic countries, and the most appealing ideology is Al-Qaeda and other groups like it, on the Internet in particular. And we've got to help our friends in the Islamic world come up with something to counterweight that ideology.
Another question in the red here, about five rows back.
What do you think the chances are for nuclear fusion, and when would that occur?
I laugh because of a personal experience with that. In 1978 was the 1 year where I was not working in the government. I was working for a research institution. And we got a contract from the Energy Department to work on nuclear fusion and plan nuclear fusion, what would happen. And our study came to the conclusion that we would have nuclear fusion in 20 years. That would have been 10 years ago. I saw a report from the Energy Department about 5 years ago that came to the conclusion that we would have nuclear fusion in 25 years. So the date when we get nuclear fusion seems to be slipping. It used to be 20 years ahead constantly. Now it's 25 years ahead constantly. So I'm not too confident that we're ever going to achieve it. But the regular old nuclear fission, the nuclear power plants that are being built around the world, France gets, I think, 80% of its power, electric power, from nuclear energy. The new technology nuclear power plants are safe and secure and have no carbon footprint.
Another question. Right here on the aisle.
We haven't talked about the press at all. And my question is, has the government so intimidated the press that they're afraid to tell us what's going on? Or is this government so secretive that the press can't find out what's going on?
A big part of the failure of the government in the period 2001 through maybe 2006 was the failure of the Congress and the failure of the media. And one thing that the Scott McClellan book says, with which I agree, and again, the irony is overwhelming, is that McClellan says, remember, he was the White House press secretary. McClellan says, the media should have done a better job of investigating and challenging what I said. Maybe you shouldn't have said it. After 9/11, there was a desire to be massively patriotic and go against the bad guys, and people equated that with wearing a flag lapel pin and saying yes to whatever the White House proposed. It turns out that saying yes to whatever the White House proposed was not a terribly smart thing to do. The system is built on the notion that we've got checks and balances. And one of those checks and balances is the Congress, and one is the media. And when they both shut down their critical faculties, we get into a mess. That's what happened.
Lady in the blue all the way back there with the red shirt.
When you talk about the issue of politicization, the problem is we've seen, certainly in the last 7 years, that it works. And I don't see any sign of it abating in the current election, even within one party, within the Democratic Party. So recognizing that that's a problem, not just with national security issues, but the whole spectrum, including cultural issues, where do we go? How do we ever get that out of the problem?
You're right. I mean, it's like negative campaigning. We all say we don't want negative ads in election campaigns, and yet everybody who runs negative ads wins. I'm hopeful that we're beginning to see that change. I'm hopeful that after the experience of the last several years, people are beginning to realize that what happened, for example, in the last presidential election, the swift voting of John Kerry, I don't think people will fall for that kind of thing again. It's remarkable they fell for it then, and they almost didn't. For a change of 60,000 votes in Ohio, we would have had a different outcome. But I think the only way to stop politicization, there, I think I got it out, is for the American people, the American voters, and commentators to call it out when they see it, when the candidate engages in it. You know, when Senator McCain, for example, says Obama is the candidate of the Hamas terrorist group, that's out of line. And that is an attempt to politicize the issue of terrorism, because factually, Senator Obama's position on the record for the last umpteen years is identical to Senator McCain's on the issue of Hamas. Now, if you had a candidate who was in fact endorsing Hamas or their goals, then it's okay to say that that's what he's doing. But when he's doing the exact opposite, then I think you're politicizing.
Another question. Right here, the lady in the white.
You mentioned accountability as being one of the cornerstones of a new paradigm. How do you propose that government officials will become accountable? What can we do? And do you ever think that Bush will be held accountable?
Let me answer the easy part first. I think you can. I have a section in the book about Hyman Rickover. And for those of you who don't remember Hyman Rickover, he was a Navy admiral for 20 years, I think he was a Navy admiral. And he created the nuclear power program for the Navy. And now all of our aircraft carriers, all of our submarines are nuclear powered. They've never had a major problem. And he was called the Tsar of the nuclear Navy. And he had a lot of power. But he also had oversight by the Congress and by the Navy. And he would set goals in conjunction with the Congress and in conjunction with the Navy. And if he didn't meet them, you know, then he could have been relieved. He always met them. He always exceeded them. I believe in having people not just accountable, but empowered. You have a problem, put somebody in charge of it. Give them instructions, give them resources, give them limits, and agree on a goal. If they don't make that goal, relieve them. If they make the goal, but only in a way that causes more problems than it helps, relieve them. And make it explicit. Government can work. It doesn't have to be soft and mushy. It can work better than the private sector. There's a myth, I think, that the private sector is a place of great management and precision. If I wrote a book, Your Private Sector Failed You, it would be twice as long.
Did you want to answer the second portion of the question?
I'm torn. When I look at people like Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith and Donald Rumsfeld and others, and they're all sort of weaseling their way back into polite society, Jerry Bremer and others. And I just know that 2 or 3 years from now, they're all going to be talking heads on networks. They're all going to be coming to the free library to promote their book. And they're going to be on corporate boards. And it's going to be like, they had a different view of Iraq, or they did something that we don't maybe all agree with in Iraq. They got us into a war by lying to us, and they ought to be indicted. There ought to be some measure of accountability. in countries around the world, South Africa, El Salvador, elsewhere, where they had a major problem, they created commissions after the fact that investigated, bipartisan commissions. Bishop Tutu was the head of the one in South Africa. And they called them commissions on national reconciliation. And what Bishop Tutu said in South Africa was, if you engaged in crimes during the apartheid era, all you need to do is admit it. Come before the commission, admit the crimes that you were involved in, and you will be forgiven and absolved. If you don't come before the commission and admit what you did, you will be arrested if there's proof that you committed crimes. Now, what's happened here is not anything like as bad as apartheid. But the notion of having a process of national reconciliation, of investigation, I think is important, because when you do something as bad as has been done, you can't just be let off the hook. Does that include the president? I don't know. That's where I get torn. I'm not sure I like the idea of when presidents leave office, the next president or the next Congress going after them. Unless, you know, in the case of Richard Nixon, they actually broke the law in obvious ways. So I'm not sure I want to see something done about the president, but unless it can be proven that he actually broke a law. But I think this entire process of selling us a phony war and getting all these people killed and wasting all this money, there has to be some accountability process, no matter who gets elected in November.
Thank you, Richard Clark.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.